Well, I've spent the morning listening to, most recently, your wonderful talk on Chinese OER at the Open Ed 2009 in Vancouver recently. And, you know, I was there and all, but I wasn't able to get to your session. But I'm really pleased that we've connected via email and you've encouraged me to listen to that because I got a lot out of that. And before that, what was the recording I listened to that we were talking about yesterday? The link you gave me was on archive.org.
Yeah, the Open Education Around the World.
And where was that talk made?
It was actually at my School of Education here at the University of Toronto.
I mean, you've got some incredible thinkers in your group there. You know, some amazing questions and comments were made directly after your talk, particularly looking at the really long-term impact of something like open textbooks, you know, affecting the curriculum in California, which is not where you're based, but there was a Californian speaking there. And your comment at the very end of that, which was just incredible, was that imagine an open history text and how that might change our education of history and how that might even have an impact on our understanding of Israel-Palestinian history. And it's just like, oh, my head was exploding with the potential impact of open textbooks, which I'd never considered before.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place to study. I mean, even though there aren't really very many other people who work in my specific area, but there are lots of people who are quite open-minded and quite interested about it. And I've had a lot of opportunities to engage. And also what I've been trying to do, because actually I'm right now I'm in the comparative education program, which is quite different, and I've never ever taken a class in educational technology or even curriculum teaching and learning, although I hang around in those circles. So, but that also forces me to see open education from other perspectives. So, for example, last year at the comparative education conference, I gave a paper where I tried to use different theories of, you know, innovation transfer and to try to analyze why did open courseware spread to certain countries and not to other countries. And so, you know, it forces you to take all these other theories. And right now I'm actually using theories of internationalization of higher ed, and I'm trying to write a paper for a teacher, you know, using their framework and looking at how OER in Africa can be looked at as a threat, as a possibility, as a, you know, so I think that's one of the really strengths of being at that place.
Yeah. I've never heard of such a subject, comparative education. So let's touch on where you're at. You're at OISE, which I, to be honest, haven't heard of before. Where is it based and what is it that you're doing, just for the benefit of whoever else is listening in?
So OISE is Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. And it's basically the Faculty of Education at the University of Toronto, but it used to be a independent institute that was merged with the faculty, and that's why it has its own name. And it's one of the largest faculties of education in the world. We have about 1,500 master's and PhD students, and probably the same number of full-time Bachelor of Education who want to become teachers, and then probably something like 6,000 or 7,000 people who come in for a continuing ed and a lot of part-time students and stuff. So it's a really huge place, and it's a very exciting place to be.
Mm. And you know, as you were saying, the subject you're in is comparative education, and it's helping you come to the question, particularly on open education, with different perspectives, which really, really comes through strongly on your two talks that I've listened to. I mean, I would thoroughly recommend anyone interested in OER to listen to those talks, because I personally gained a heck of a lot out of listening to those and thinking about my own work at Otago Polytechnic. So what is the program that you're involved with, comparative education, and where are the particular focus points that you're on at the moment?
So first of all, thanks a lot for those words, because I feel exactly the same about reading your blog and seeing all the stuff that you've done and so many other people in the community. Actually, I was considering putting the short video that you put together from Otago Polytech into that talk that you walked, the two-hour talk that you watched, because we thought that would be a really interesting example for us to discuss as you know, what could we do as an institution. But to answer your question, I was really split when I went into this school, because I'm really interested in teaching and learning in higher education. and both face-to-face and online, and of course open education. But I'm not exclusively interested in open education. I have lots of other, questions that I'd like answered as well. But the way it's organized, and this seems to be a common thing in North America, is that either you study curriculum teaching and learning, which is a big department and which almost exclusively focuses on K through 12, so kindergarten to grade 12 of high school, or you go to the theory and policy studies department, which has history, philosophy, ed admin, and higher education, which is where I am at. But the problem is that none of the courses talk about what happens in the classroom. They all talk about, internationalization of higher ed and government research policy and the history of community colleges and all kinds of very interesting things, but they don't mention this one thing. So, I mean, luckily you can kind of stretch yourself. You can hang out with people from other departments. And actually, one of the professors that I presented on in that 2-hour talk is my second reader for my master's thesis, and he's from curriculum teaching and learning, and he's doing a lot of things with digital classrooms. So, you can make those connections yourself, but they certainly aren't made for you. And then, on top of that, basic degree in higher education, we have a cross-faculty program in comparative education, and it's called Comparative International Development Education, CIDE. And basically, anyone who's interested in education outside of the borders of their own country, particularly with a comparative perspective, but it doesn't have to be, or they're interested in internationalization of education, of curricula, they're looking at, want to look at educational programs in different countries. Even whether they come from higher ed or from curriculum teaching and learning or from Institute for Child Studies or from different, for sociology and equity in education, they can all come together and take a few courses together and do seminars together and kind of share that interest in international stuff. And that's really an amazing group to work with because the minimum criteria to be accepted is to have taught in a different country for at least a year. So you
Wow.
have this group of people who all have, very strong experiences in very many different countries and who are doing all kinds of different work and really supportive.
Yeah, and so that comes through in the recordings when the question time happens, particularly in that first recording. It's just such insightful questions, and I was envying you. It just makes for such a different feeling about your work when you get really good questions and comments like that. That seem to be in tune with the topic rather than it just always being an introductory level. So just for the benefit of whoever ends up listening to these recordings, I might just read out the URL to the recordings that I'm referring to that leads us to talk on here now. Your talk at Open Education, sorry, the website is openedconference.org and /archives/511 will lead you to Stian's talk on Chinese open courseware, a case study of a large state-sponsored program. And just on that, well, no, I'll talk about the other ones. Stian, can you tell us the URL on the archive.org for the recording for the previous one we're referring to, where you gave a talk at your institution? And just while you're locating that, unless you have it handy now, do you?
Well, I think the simplest thing for anyone who's interested would be to go to my blog because I link to all of the recordings
Okay.
there. So if you go to my blog, which is reganmian.net, that's reganmian.net, and you click on Publications and Presentations, you'll see all the
Good.
publications that I have online linked to on SlideShare, and there's a link to audio and video where I have that available.
Okay. And in case people don't know who I am when they're listening to, I work at the Otago Polytechnic in New Zealand. And unlike Stian, I'm not involved in a master's or a PhD. I work in an educational development centre, or anyone gutsy enough to employ me, I guess, because and it's always involved in developing open education methods, helping teachers understand open education, and then go about however they think it is to achieve open education. but I particularly encourage the use of social media, being teachers uploading videos to YouTube or uploading slides to SlideShare or editing Wikipedia or engaging in discussions on any media wiki or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, Stian, I mean, I don't really know where to start because there you mentioned that you have questions that you would like answered and I have questions that I'd like answered. And what I'm interested to know is where our questions correspond and where we could help each other further in those questions. See, I'm quite new to your work now. I've seen these videos. I've read through your blog a little bit. And I'm really wanting to talk with you because you have this very lateral, even international perspective on OER. So maybe could you start us off with a question that you are dealing with in your work, looking at the kind of international or multi-use of OER?
Well, there's so many different angles that you could come at it.
Yeah.
Actually, as I said, right now I'm actually trying to finish a paper for a friend of mine who is a international expert in internationalization of higher education, which is a field I don't have much background in. And she's in Africa right now going to a conference of people who do research on internationalization of higher education in Africa. And she got very inspired by my talk and she said that I find it very interesting and I would like to integrate this in my research. Why should these people in Africa care? If you're a person in Africa who's researching internationalization of higher education as a researcher, you know, why should open education be on your agenda? Why is this something that's really important? And what are some of the things that you should consider? So that's what I'm trying to kind of, because I always think it's fun to try to pull new different groups into this and tell them that even though you're not a educational technologist, this is something that's really relevant to your work and we would really appreciate your perspectives on this. So I've been sitting here for the last few hours kind of brainstorming, and also because she forces me to be critical, which is hard for me because although I am critical about many open education projects, I'm also unabashedly positive about the concept, the fundamental concept.
Yeah.
But she's also trying to force me to be critical. Well, what are the risks for African universities? You know, what
that's the question I like.
Dangers.
Yeah. I mean, one of the points. I mean, first of all, your talk about the Chinese OER, which led her to the question. You touch on initially three areas that might inspire work in open education, and I'm just trying to recall what those three were, but the one that you added to those three, which really stood out for me, was the one that you added after engaging with Chinese OER workers, and that was simply the process of publishing OER helps to change methods of teaching. Maybe you could explain that better, but to me that really stood out. And then you also go on to, well, first of all, can you just remind me what are the other three? So just maybe give us a little bit of an outline of those four points that you use to understand motivations to OER.
Yeah, so basically this is something I came up with after reading Mike Caulfield, who argued that people were perhaps criticizing MIT OpenCourseWare on false pretenses or looking at it from the wrong perspective, thinking that this would be so this is what my takeaway message was, that either it could be used directly to study from. I want to learn economics. I will go on the MIT economics course and I will learn. It will teach me. I will study with it. Or they will use it as a resource base. They would, you know, reuse resources. They would take modules and integrate it into their own teaching and so on and so on. And people felt that perhaps the resources on the MIT site were not sufficient for either of these two different kind of usages. And he suggested the third one, which he called transparency, but he also exemplified by kind of, you know, open your windows and let people peek in, which I thought was really neat, which is the idea that, I don't want to directly learn from this, and I don't want to take something and actually reuse it, but I'd like to see what you're doing, and maybe that'll inspire me. and maybe I'm interested in that for different kinds of reasons. So for me, who has a real interest in education around the world, and that's what I'm studying as well, you know, being able to go to the Indian Institute of Technology and see their videos, even though I'm not that interested in particle physics, but I find, you know, being able to see their videos being really interesting as kind of a, just like if I was in Bangalore, I might actually take the bus there and sneak into the back of the bench and just sit there and observe how they're doing it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And but when you went to China, you added to those three, and pointing out that they're doing it primarily perhaps because they think the process of doing it inspires new thinking, not necessarily those other three, but new thinkings on how they do things and how to improve undergraduate education in China. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Right, so the Chinese program I've been looking at ever since I heard about it when I did David Wiley's course, which is how I kind of got into this. And I, because I have a background in China, I should mention I speak Chinese and my wife is Chinese. And so I was very curious about this, and it seemed it was extremely hard to find any information about it in English, rather apart from the fact that apparently it existed and it was massive. And I was very, and I also visited a number of these sites because, of course, they're open and you could go look at them if you speak Chinese. And I thought it was a lot of fun to once again be able to sit here and, you know, I watched a political science lecture from China where the professor defined democracy, you know, and I thought that was just extremely interesting to see.
I bet it was.
Actually, it wasn't because he pretty much just said what you would say in North America and never made reference to China at all. But
Yeah, right.
that's interesting in its own way.
It is,
So, but I was always kind of curious as to what they were actually trying to achieve. And one of the things also is that because this program is mainly funded by the Ministry of Education centrally, which gives out money to the universities that apply for it for kind of the best courses. They don't suffer under many of the constraints that institutions do, because there are things I think that, for example, MIT or many other universities that do their own open programs, they, you know, they have certain constraints because they have to raise funding, they have to argue for their pro to their provost that this is, you know, beneficial to the institution in many different ways. Whereas here you have a Ministry of Education whose ideally only purpose is to further education in the country. And so you would hope that they could actually design the program to be an ideal program rather than we should be happy with whatever we can get. But I was very curious, and I read a number of articles in Chinese because there's about 3,000 papers written about this program in Chinese. So it's, you know, there are lots of research institutes in China doing research on this. It just doesn't exist in the Western world. And I still was quite confused about, because they mentioned a number of different purposes. It could be, you know, it could benefit many different people, but I felt that if you didn't define who you were trying to benefit or how, what you were trying to achieve, it would be also very difficult to measure whether you were achieving that. But then when I started talking to some people who had been quite involved in the process, they actually told me that, for example, it's quite rare in China for senior professors, full professors, to participate in undergraduate teaching, because they would, you know, teach graduate students, they would do outside consultancies and write papers and go to conferences. So one of the things you have to do to get this grant, you have to form, you can't apply as a singular individual, but you have to form a teaching group, which typically includes both some kind of young gung-ho professors who are tech savvy and interesting in getting this done, but also some very senior academics who are, you know, the authority in their fields. In many occasions, they were, you know, the people who wrote the first textbook ever in this subject. And you, so just by actually bringing these people together in a group and having them sit down and reflect about the curriculum, I think that's, you're doing something good. And you're bringing these senior people into the teaching. And one professor I interviewed, he also made another point and said that when this program started in 2003, the government really wanted to encourage more use of technology within institutions. You know, things like that we've become accustomed to in North America with, you know, every class having a blackboard site and putting up resources and so blended learning, you could call it. But that many of the professors were not really ready for this. They felt that they didn't know enough about the technology, and so they so she actually mentioned that by forcing you to create these open educational resources, you also force them to become acquainted with publishing web pages and so on. And so this whole process of, because the big difference between the Chinese program and the MIT program, for example, is that the MIT program, they take everything and they say, well, the mere fact that you're an MIT professor and you teach here means that this is good stuff. Whereas in China, you apply and it's a great honor for you to get, not just for you, but also for your faculty and for your university
And there's
to get this.
the dynamic that I really took a lot from. And then also you pointed out that each course or each open courseware, if we want to call it that, in the Chinese model, has its own web page, its own different platform. And so you have this very eclectic mix of approaches and styles. And I'm thinking to myself, is this deliberate? Is the Chinese Ministry of Education, have they deliberately taken a light-footed approach by basically setting up the conditions? So this pride in getting an award for the best open education and the whole principle, I guess, about open education, but then hands off, not providing a platform, not providing any other thing, but simply saying, let's see your open education stuff and we'll give an award for it. And then that being the deliberate steps behind that being to give the staff and academic and the teachers the freedom to discover for themselves and the diversity and range of approaches and the opportunity to come together. And so, do you think it was deliberate in that sense, that hands-off approach, or do you think it was accidental? I mean, either way, I think the outcome is excellent. It would just be astounding to think that the Ministry of Ed deliberately took that light-footed approach when you compare to sort of New Zealand Ministry of Ed or Australian or maybe even Canadian, where they do provide the platform and framework of thinking, et cetera, and then people kind of fall into line with that as though they'd never considered any of this before. What are your thoughts on that sort of comment?
Well, so the continuation of what I was just saying, the second difference between this and MIT is that at MIT, people are asked to kind of provide a snapshot of what they're currently teaching. The OCW is never intended to change what you actually physically teach, although in some cases it could, because suddenly you feel, oh, I'm on video, maybe I won't make so many bush jokes or something like that. But fundamentally, that was never, the intention at all. However, in the Chinese case, it was absolutely the intention. You are not at all expected to put just what you teach currently online because that won the prize and that's good enough. Rather, this money and this opportunity is supposed to give you the chance to sit down and fundamentally rethink your course, to go and consult. And many of them actually mentioned that they also consulted some foreign sites. They looked at OCW, they looked at different courses in China. So both the curriculum, they want the most up-to-date curriculum, and they also want the most up-to-date teaching methodology. However, there's an important distinction from what you just said or what I just heard you say. They're not supposed to come up with the best open education course, so to say. They're supposed to come up with the best face-to-face course, and then and that's how it's evaluated. It's not evaluated as, the best web resource at all. And then the web resource is kind of just to share the achievements of the face-to-face class. And ideally, at least from the beginning, I think, to inspire other teachers to improve their own face-to-face teaching. That seems to have been the initial purpose. And in that case, you could also argue that having everyone come up with their own platform is quite wasteful. I read some articles where they suggested that 30% of the money went to them hiring external web companies to do these sites, which aren't necessarily functional, but often very fancy with lots of flash and animations and useless animations. Now, what seems to have happened is that there's a bit of a mission creep where, and I think this is partly inspired by, I'm still trying to dig down in this, but my sense is that it started largely as an independent effort, as an idea that wasn't really at all designed to produce open educational resources. That was almost like a side effect. It's quite misleading to call it kind of Chinese open courseware, although it's
Right.
hard to know what else to call it. But clearly, people in China have been affected by all this foreign open courseware, and many of the people researching the Chinese program are also researching what's happening in the U.S. and around the world. And so suddenly they start writing articles about whether students can use this directly and so on. And we actually see some of the evaluation criteria that the ministry puts out that each year have been changed in the last few years, that now they suddenly want some added interactivity to the website, which is quite different from where they started. And this is when we were emailing yesterday about my four purposes that I came up with, and you said that you didn't necessarily see them conflict, and I said, and I still believe that if you're trying to design a web page that is ideal for online learning with lots of interactive quizzes and I don't know what, that is a different purpose than if you're trying to reflect in the best way possible how you personally are teaching face to face and how another person and another school could teach you face to face as well.
But how do you come to that realization? I mean, to me, it the way they have done it is similar to the way that we've done it in Otago Polytechnic, in that really people are coming to these realizations through the process. There was no way that we could have anticipated the results of simply going open education. So one teacher might be going, well, I'm going to just put my face-to-face classes online in some way, just to complement the face-to-face class. Another teacher might do as the Chinese model was, is I'm going to rethink the way I do face-to-face and put it represented online. And another one saying, well, I'm going to just teach online. And then through the process of that, each of them coming to realize a different approach and a different reasoning for doing it after they've started doing it. So how could they possibly, or how could anyone anticipate and therefore plan the scope of what they're doing if they don't know what they're doing? It's a classic old conundrum, I guess.
Absolutely, but I think one of the things that I think the program in China is extremely, exciting and interesting. But one of the things that scares me a bit sometimes is, yes, we don't know where we're going, and we're kind of bumbling our way, forward. So I mean, my work with peer-to-peer university right now is the perfect example. We have no idea what it's going to look like a year from now, or even half a year from now. However, because China started so early and set up such a massive program, which it really is, and which everyone in the field have heard about it, they're aware of it. It's written about in their journals. It's not some tiny thing. It's really kind of massive. And it's very centrally controlled. It's very difficult for you. It's very specific about who gets it and how it works, and it's tied into the reputation of the university. So some professors told me that their department said, "Oh, we really need some of these designations, for our reputation." So who's got a course that they can put in? The problem is whether if that overshadows this kind of experimentation and bumbling, because this is, the only game in town. And the thing that surprised me a bit was that when I talked to a number of people who were, people in China who were doing research on digital, online education, who were quite interested in Web 2.0 and networked learning and stuff like that, they all, if they didn't themselves have a course which was part of this system, they all kind of offhandedly just completely dismissed it as uninteresting, and they said, "Oh, yeah, it's a government thing. It's not really, nobody really uses it. It's not really that great." And what I tried to argue, especially to a group of very, very interesting people in Beijing, where I said, "You should try to make the best out of it, because you are not the Minister of Education. If you're the Minister of Education, if I was giving a talk by any chance to the Chinese Minister of Education, I might say, well, is this really the best way that you can spend your money?" But I'm not. I'm giving my talk to a number of individuals in Beijing who have great ideas. So you can't stop this program, but can you do something positive with it? Could you, for example, look at these courses and find these really great elements and tie them all together and create kind of a Wiley Wiki course out of that, with the mailing list and stuff like that? Could you, come up with cool ways of reusing it rather than just saying, "Oh, that's a yeah, whatever,"
And you mentioned also that, which is really interesting in terms of comparing a sort of, you know, a, generally speaking, a Western and an Eastern perspective on sharing, and that we in the West tend to feel like we need a license, a copyright license that enables sharing. And you were saying that in China, it's just a matter of course that they share and they'd feel like they don't need a license. And then you did flag, you know, that there are complexities to that perspective. But is that perspective generally pervasive in China, that sharing is a matter of course, and so therefore openly publishing stuff to the internet or just going ahead and reusing whatever the ministry stuff has put up in a positive way, there is no barrier in terms of ideas about copyright? Is that the case?
See, that's a really tricky issue, and I've thought a lot about it, and I've tried to engage actually a number of times different people in China who are you know, deeply embedded in these kind of practices in debates, but most of them are not very interested actually in discussing it, which is kind of funny. So I kind of feel like this Westerner comes, you know, really wanting to discuss this thing that nobody else cares about.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say so much that sharing is embedded. I would say that taking is embedded.
Right.
That's not so it's not some kind of a bad judgment about their character, but more in the way that things go on, everything is pirated in China, just as a matter of course. And I mean, the book industry is just amazing. Like any book published the last 10 years, you can find it online in HTML. It's not even like a bad PDF scan. Mm. It's in HTML, and it's just amazing.
Mm.
And so clearly the same thing could possibly happen with all these courses if anyone found they were valuable enough to. But I see that as a very different thing, though, than sharing, because sharing includes the intention of the sender.
Mm.
And so that's why I was arguing that, you know, on your blog, and I forget who else's blog, we're discussing these issues, that Creative Commons has a value, not so much because it stops you from being sued, because as we discussed before, I wouldn't sue anyone in most, you know, cases. However, as a social movement that says, yes, it's good to share, and yes, I'm tagging this because I would like you to reuse this. It would make me happy if you did.
Mm.
And of course, because of that, I'm also going to facilitate that with the kind of file types I put online and with the kind of things that happen. And that isn't as prevalent.
Yeah.
So I think that those are two different issues.
It is. And for me, it's kind of disappointing because then I'm at a point where I don't like the idea of us needing a license to say we share. I would prefer to find something where it's just a matter of our ethical conduct that we do share as a matter of course. And so, but I completely understand what you're saying about the difference in China might be that more, not so much that they share, but that is to take, the right to take, or just the ability to take. So it's a kind of a shame at both ends, is that, like you say, is that the Chinese don't necessarily, generally speaking, have this notion of sharing, but we have in the West a legal license that says we share, but we don't actually have an inbuilt anymore, I suppose, an inbuilt ethic as a matter of course on everyone to say that we just share and reuse and take, which is the thing I'm trying to find in my blog at the moment, in the writing of the blog, is that I worry about the Creative Commons license using that ethic of sharing. And I think the legalities of copyright and Creative Commons hack on copyright is quite different to the ethical dimension of the idea of sharing. And it's saddening a little bit to see that we're using a legal mechanism or a legal hack to enable sharing. But at the same time, by introducing Creative Commons to other places that don't necessarily have copyright, we're saying, here's Creative Commons, this enables you to share. But at the same time, what we're saying is, here's Creative Commons and here is copyright and all the reasons why not to share, but here's your device to share, if you know what I mean. It's kind of like the Creative Commons is a vehicle for bringing this idea of copyright to a place. And therefore, it's like introducing money, I suppose, to a whole culture of people who had no idea about money.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe what we should have is some kind of a symbol that was not legal. Like, I could put a picture of, I don't know, a sun or whatever happy, you know, peace symbol or whatever on my
Yeah.
blog, which had no legal standing whatsoever, which was not a license or anything. It just said,
Yeah.
"Hey guys, I'm," as opposed to not just ignore, like just ignoring whether you share or not. I'm actively encouraging you. I'm, you know, happy, happy go happy. We're hippies, kind of thing, and just and just kind of disconnecting that from the. I mean, I'm just thinking aloud here because this isn't something I've given a lot of thought. But yeah, maybe that's what we need to do and disconnect kind of the sharing, the encouraging sharing movement, which I think is something that Creative Commons has done that is really
Yes,
positive because,
it's certainly.
you know, I published a poetry collection with a number of friends when I was 14 or 15, and you know, we had a copyright. We, you know, because we printed it as a book and we wanted it to be very professional, so we had copyright those people, and we even had this silly message about, you know, if you copy it, we'll hunt you down, we know where you live, kind of thing. And it wasn't because we ever thought we would make any money or because of anything. It was just because we want to be like the cool guys, like the real poets, and that's what they did. And the same thing, I published a software program that was really silly in Visual Basic, but it was shareware, not, you know, because I didn't know that there was something else. And now, of course, it's all the cool kids are doing open source and Creative Commons and stuff, because that's, you know, so maybe, so I think that's a really positive thing, and I think that is something that China and India and other places can really, you know, that we can share with them, that they could learn, perhaps learn from us, but then maybe that we don't need to share our respect for copyright. So maybe we need to separate those two.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people suggest that we use the public domain symbol, but to me, that still acknowledges the existence of copyright and an economy of not sharing, basically. And so I like the idea of some symbol like a rainbow or a peace symbol, but even better would be just the act of publishing. So just the act of speaking out loud, writing it down, putting up a website is the gesture to say, I'm sharing, rather than then sort of trying to protect something that you've published. Because the act of publishing is projecting your ideas or making your ideas available to someone, and they're out of your body, you don't own them anymore in a sort of way. But I think we're probably a long way, at least in the West, a long way from coming back to that line of thinking. So I guess an interim step would be to come up with some symbol that represents the idea of rejecting copyright and protection of so-called intellectual property and things like that. Yes. The question I
Yeah,
have,
because,
yep. No, you go
well,
ahead.
you know, it does frustrate me a lot because I see all these wonderful resources, and really, and I find it wonderful that these are kind of homegrown movements, not, you know, MIT, like the OpenCourseWare Consortium. I mean, they do good stuff, but it's a very kind of American-led movement. Whereas, you know, this stuff that is in China, or, you know, I talked about the textbooks in Indonesia, which is quite amazing. You know, the Ministry of Education decided to buy the copyright for 600 textbooks and put it all online for free, so that, and actually to foster competition, so that different, you know, local print houses could print cheap textbooks for kids that, of course, don't have internet, because internet connectivity is really bad in Indonesia, but, you know, and in India, with this incredible amount of resources at the Indira Gandhi National Open University, which it really frustrates me that that hasn't gotten more press in the open education sphere. But once again, all of these three cases are not, A, they're not under an open license, and in all cases explicitly so. It's not like they forgot to put it there. It says it's copyright, blah, blah, blah. But B, it's also in a format that doesn't encourage sharing. It's in, you know, these PDFs with pictures, and you know, so if I want to translate one of the really cute children's textbooks from India into English, that's going to be a hellish task, because I'd have to try to, you know, so it's so wonderful, and I just want them to go that little step further, you know, and I'm not quite sure, you know, what kind of arguments or you know, who how that can happen.
And I
But
wondered
I
too
think that
if they're using you know, the copyright symbol, the same reason why most people, I think, use the copyright symbol, because that's what you do if you publish something, not really thinking about that all rights reserve and that restrictive thinking behind it. And perhaps in cases somewhere else around the world, without even a legal framework in their country to back up that kind of claim. It's unfortunate.
Exactly, and so that's when I talk to people in those places. I give examples like I talk about Wikipedia and how people can and show lots of examples of how people can work together and CC Mixer, which I think is a great example of reuse, because sadly we don't really have any good examples of reuse that I know of in the open education sphere, except for translation. But in other spheres, like in music and video, I mean, there's just these examples of how being open doesn't mean just you get it for free. It means that you enable all these amazing things that couldn't happen otherwise. And I think that's the really important message.
And that's a nice lead into my other question. Seeking comment from you is we don't see the reuse in the educational resources nearly as much, if at all, compared to just the everyday cultural stuff. So the remixing in YouTube, the remixing in the Wikipedia and encyclopedia articles, the remixing of music and photos and blogging and all of that sort of real world stuff. But the minute it becomes educational, and that's like a composition of all these things into a textbook or something like that, we see that remix and that reappropriation slow right down to a halt. So my question, I suppose, on that is, us operating in this educational domain, is that really productive? Why don't we spend more time researching in the popular media domain, where dialogue and conversations are happening, and why don't we observe that and look to where learning is happening there rather than learning happening in the institutionalized sense, that being textbooks and educational curriculum and all of that sort of stuff.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the big barriers to that kind of thing happening in education is all the big institutional players who all want to put out their own stuff with their own name because and now we're back at those kind of secondary reasons for funding OER and those constraints that leads to, that X university would much rather launch X university OpenCourseWare and get all their alumni in to give money and be proud of that rather than take, for example, say that wow, there are all these really awesome resources on something from China, and we're going to translate it and we're going to repurpose it so that it's useful for North American students, and we're going to spend resources on that, and that's going to benefit everyone. We don't see people doing that,
And take it to
and
the
I
next
think
step.
that's where.
Where the Americans perhaps translate the Chinese text, but instead of hosting it on their own server, giving it back to the Chinese to host on their server to make their website bilingual, perhaps, or probably a more realistic example, although that would be nice to see, is so-called institution sets up on a UniTube, being university YouTube take, putting all their videos in there instead of on YouTube where everybody goes to find videos. I mean, sure, put them on both, but certainly put them on YouTube because that's at the moment where everybody goes to check out videos. Or again, lecturers creating resources taking from Wikipedia, but not actually engaging in editing and helping to maintain the Wikipedia articles or using the Wikipedia articles and discussions as a primary resource in their education. I don't know how we encourage that sort of. We see it even in the open ed movement, as you just cited. We've got the university blog systems and we've got the university wiki systems, and all of them are in a way diluting what could be a collective by just using the popular platforms as they exist today, bearing in mind a backup system, which is the reasoning or the rationale why they do it in the first place, but using the popular systems that they exist today and backing up locally, but primarily using the popular.
Right, exactly. And I mean, that's the thing that's always frustrated me with this OpenCourseWare business, is why is it organized by university? If I go to the OpenCourseWare Consortium, I can click on university and then I click on faculty and I can find something. I don't really care. I just want to know. I just want some good resources on macroeconomics. Why don't why do you have 10 different courses called Economics 101? Why don't you pool those resources and of course, then you try to overcome that by having these courseware finders, but all they do is they find 10 separate courses on on economics that are all quite bad, rather than all of those people pooling that and actually having kind of a hand-edited page that had so much richer material. And so for luckily, we have people like this videolectures.net or something that actually sucked in all these videos from different places and put them all together. And that's something that should have been done in the first place.
Yeah.
As you said, just put it on YouTube, just put it somewhere else. But I mean, the good thing is that at least using an open license enables other people to come after you and
Yeah.
say, well, you've done your share, you've taken the money from your institution, and you've done what you could do. And I think that that's where there's a huge role for individuals or people who are less, volunteers and people who are less tampered by these kind of restrictions. And that's why I said in China, to these people who were kind of these very interesting activists, Web 2.0 kind of people, and I said, don't look at whether Chinese open courseware is a good or bad thing. Look at what can you do with it. And maybe if you say, or don't ask if this course is bad, but say, can we go through all these courses and collect enough resources that we can make it, that we can make it work,
Yes, I mean, when I compose my courses, I'm always dipping into YouTube. I've got my select little places where I go and search for resources, and I'm conscious that I've never dipped into Connections or I've never dipped into MIT OpenCourseWare. Not that I ever would because it's too restrictive, but and so. That has me always thinking, of why aren't I going to those educational resources? Because they're just not as quick and easy to use as, I'm going to check this week for a lecture video in YouTube, and no, it's not there. Okay, I'll check again next week, and there it is, sort of stuff. It's just so profound and huge. But it leads me to questioning peer-to-peer university now, the project you're working on, is how you treat these issues? Because, on the one hand, peer-to-peer could be seen as another side project. Why isn't peer-to-peer happening inside Wikiversity? Or the other way around, why isn't Wikiversity happening inside peer-to-peer? Or how can the two correlate so that they're enhancing each other's efforts?
Well, I mean, but just let me say one short thing about your previous argument first. I think another thing that really is holding us back right now with regard to doing this kind of curation work, which you could call it, which I think is really important and has a lot of potential, because there is lots of good stuff out there, whether it's hidden in some OpenCourseWare course or whether it's some random YouTube video or whatever. They're all kind of equally inaccessible until someone finds them and links to them and whatever, adds metadata and blogs them and stuff. Is that it's for anything but kind of HTML text. It's very hard right now to reuse things. If there's a 2-hour video from a MIT course and I want my students to look at 15 minutes, how do I do that? That's actually ridiculously complicated. I have to I mean, I tried to open a 2-hour video in iMovie once, and I think the thing crashed on me. Just to do that, and I don't know if you saw the little 3-minute kind of collage I did of different OpenCourseWare videos. That took me forever to make, and sometimes I have to actually use a screencasting tool to record a streaming video of my, because I just couldn't get it, and it was just absurd to me. So just make, and the same thing with PDFs and stuff, just making this stuff physically more remixable, I think, would be one step. But anyway, talking about peer-to-peer university, I mean, I often, it might be a bit of a fake separation, but I often separate between kind of resources and process. And I see, I don't know, I haven't spent enough time on Wiki Educator, but certainly, I see that there's a lot of really good resources there. And we would certainly be extremely happy to use some of that. I don't know if where any of our courses are right now, or but there's no reason why they wouldn't. And we would even be happy to have our students contribute to those resources, to build new resources as part of their courses. But what we're primarily concerned about is conducting learning. That sounds, the process of having people come together in groups and cohorts, as Mike Caulfield calls them, and conducting, and learning together and linking out to resources that exist all over the internet. And we also want to experiment with. And I don't necessarily think that a straight media wiki is the best tool for what we're looking for,
Okay,
especially
that.
because we want to experiment in the future with, different ways of students building portfolios, evaluating each other, et cetera, et cetera. But either way, all of that is supposed to be kind of a superstructure above all the material that exists, that, you know, we don't want to hoard our own material at all. That's not the purpose.
Yeah, so there's two comments. I mean, there's Wiki Educator and there's Wikiversity. I'm currently spending more time in Wikiversity lately, just to compare the differences for this very same question, is why do we have Wiki Educator and Wikiversity? Both do content and both do learning process, learning courses and research projects and discussion forums and all that sort of stuff, as well as, you know, just straight bad content. And then, you know, when it's only content, why is it there on Wikiversity or Wiki Educator and not on Wikibooks or Wikipedia and things like that? And but at the moment, I'm spending time in Wikiversity. And as you probably know, a lot of my work is simply following the Wiley Wiki models and designing a sequence of process to go through to help people understand a certain topic and develop kind of networks around the topic so that they can continue learning about it, etc. But the point you just made is the Media Wiki is not all, you know, it's not the be all and end all of how that happens, and that's dead right. And so to me, that meta level that you refer to becomes the internet as a whole. And it's well to say, you know, Peter Rawshorn over in Vancouver is about to release a paper called The Internet is the Platform. And it's well to say, but it takes a fair bit of digital literacy to get to that point where you're using the internet as a platform and, you know, easily migrating between the two. But then these different projects do a lot to inadvertently lock people into those particular programs. It's, as you say, it's difficult to easily use, say if I find an image on Flickr, licensed to Creative Commons, it's not straightforward for me to have that image appear in the Wikiversity page. I actually have to download it from Flickr and re-upload it to Wikiversity. Somebody's probably going to tell me that there's some obscure tool that enables it, but it should be as straightforward as what we know and do on blogs in terms of embedding the HTML to make it appear. Yeah, so this problem of the conflicting efforts preventing us from finding that seamless internet as a platform of learning. I'm not sure if we're closer or we're moving further and further away from it.
Well, I mean, one thing is the technology, which I was talking about, although in a way it's a bit of a red herring, because right now we're using it, a platform that's a lot less capable than MediaWiki, which is just something we grabbed to be able to launch in time and get this thing on the road while we think about how we're going to develop something of our own. But more to the point, you know, having spent some time on Wikiversity and on MediaWiki, Wiki Educator, having a look around at least, and also some other platforms which are kind of free-for-alls in that anyone can, you know, edit and start new pages and stuff like that. And none of them seem to me as, you know, very huge successes when it comes to, once again, learning. Now, I think especially Wiki Educator has produced a lot of great content, and maybe some of the, I am less familiar with Wiki Educator, but, you know, I've been thinking a lot, because I love the David Wiley's course. I mean, that was my introduction, and I've been looking a lot at these other Wiley Wiki courses and been very inspired by those as well, and thinking, you know, how can we, because the problem to me is that almost all the courses I've seen have been about education.
Mm.
I think maybe you have a few that aren't from Otago, but largely, you know, there are all these EdTech people teaching other EdTech people about education. And so what our basic idea was, we want to take this model, but we want to mainstream it, and we want to make it much easier for people who don't have the same institutional support, who don't have the same tech literacy and aren't that into open ed, to do this. But I also thought about myself, and I thought, what is it that makes me willing to spend that much time and that much effort when I don't even get any accreditation? You know, I get learning. And yet, when I look at some of these other platforms, I'm not that interested in, you know. And part of it is, so we're kind of, and this is my own kind of view of it. But we're, at least from the beginning, we're deliberately not a free for all, right? We're very tightly controlled, and right now that's not scalable at all. But hopefully, we'll be able to build a community and the technological tools that makes that scalable. it's definitely not meant to be, you have to be a professor to teach here, but it's meant to be, this is a course offered by peer-to-peer university, then it must have gone through certain, it has a certain kind of quality. The teacher's not going to just leave in the middle, and the students are quite committed, and they're quite interesting people, and it's kind of a quality sign. And I don't think that's at all the only model, but I think that's the model that it's really interesting to test, and that has a value.
But perhaps the flaw in both of our thinking then is to mimic an institutionalized idea of the education. So I think it's a wonderful name you've got, the peer-to-peer university. It says it all, really. But like Wikiversity and like peer-to-peer university, they're just in the namesake alone is mimicking the idea of a large organizational approach to learning. Whereas the thing that I found inspiring about you looking at the Chinese OER is you had lots of different courses, albeit only just representing face-to-face study online, but they're all on different platforms and all different flavors. And then I'm thinking about the teachers we work with at the Otago Polytechnic. We have a horticulture teacher who primarily uses Blip TV to post videos to, and then her blog, theoretically, her blog to bring it all together. In fact, I think she's using the wiki to bring it all together. But then we have cooks using YouTube, and YouTube is their primary device for their course. And then we have myself using Wikiversity and Wikieducator, sampling all sorts of different materials. Then we have people using Google Group Email Forum, others using WordPress, others using Blogger. So we have this really eclectic mix of different approaches of using the technology for 100% online or complementing face-to-face and online, which I think wholly is going to be more sustainable because it's all very, very small elements not being grouped under an umbrella, except a conceptual umbrella being Otago Polytechnic. But there is no platform to say that everyone is on this. The platform is the internet, in other words. So perhaps the flaw in our thinking is to mimic the institutionalized idea of it.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's an interesting, interesting discussion. I mean, in a way, we are, we're looking at alternative ways of getting accreditation, and that's a very traditional idea. And even though we're looking at alternative ways of getting accreditation, that concept of kind of fitting in somehow to the that's still a very traditional idea, but there are lots of people out there who still need it. And I'm very skeptical to it from, I mean, actually that's another paper I'm hoping to write is to look to use these theory like sociological theories about the credentialism and stuff like that and looking at how that would if how they would look at open education. But still, I mean, a lot of people need this stuff, and so that's that's not the be all and end all, but it's something that we're interested in investigating. And maybe then we could take that, push that further, and we say, okay, we're not that interested in you getting, an equivalency exam, but we're interested in you applying for a job and being able to show a portfolio of work that you've done in a number of different informal settings, and that maybe that gives you the job. Maybe that's more,
I like that response definitely, is that we do in I mean, obviously, we have a structure of accreditation and institutionalized learning, all that sort of stuff that we are coming from and need to speak back to. And so that is the goal in it, is how do we get all of these informal and formal learning taking place wherever it's taking place and getting it recognized by, I don't know, the people who give pay rises and give jobs. The reason we do our education, I suppose, if we need accreditation, that is. So, I think obviously if peer-to-peer university was to find ways to get their courses recognized by other institutions, which is very, very possible, as well as Wikiversity courses, etc., that would be a great thing. Stian, we've been talking for over an hour, so we should wrap it up, I reckon.
Yeah, well, I guess at least, I mean, I could talk for 5 more hours, but I guess for the benefit of people listening to us,
Well, we should probably come again. We should come together again. There's so many things that we can grapple on. The one thing that I really have appreciated is getting some insights on your, you know, I can't look at Chinese open courseware because I can't read Chinese. I can speak a little bit, but that's nothing for being able to read it and actually access the thinking that's going behind there. So having you there is showing a whole different approach to open courseware and open education that is not often spoken about in the English speaking networks. So you've opened a whole new world of thinking, and it's sort of giving me different perspectives and different ways of thinking about my work. So I hope you continue to delve into those places and draw out what's going on and then superimpose your thinking over the top of that to help us interpret it. It's been very valuable for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. And I mean, yeah, I would love to do this again. I mean, this time it was mainly you asking me questions, although we had a good conversation there, but I've lots of things I'd ask you too. And I mean, as I mentioned to you, right now we're doing a lot of thinking about how we can build, you know, this as a community in peer-to-peer university, and I'm sure that's somewhere you have quite a bit of experience. So
maybe
we'll
so.
Talk about that.
It's a bit of a holy grail. And the other one you talked about we didn't really address was the challenge in the African, I'm not sure what country it was in Africa, asking you about what the risks are with open education. And one of the questions I asked the Catherine from Kenya at the Open Education Conference is, to what extent is open education a kind of inadvertent vehicle for neo-colonialism, which was a horrible question to ask of her. We're friends now and everything, but that's another thing I worry about, which is, you know, copyright going to places where countries didn't have a copyright law and impacting on their ideas of sharing, and likewise with the subjects that get packed up in our so-called open courseware, getting holus bolus used in another place, and then with it goes all the thinking and values and stuff.
So yeah, definitely.
yeah, another one, another hour. Yeah. Dion, it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
You too. Thanks so much.
Okay.